So All Saints Day is one of these somewhat irregular feast days because it doesn't specify in particular an event in the life of Jesus and doesn't celebrate clearly or directly part of the drama of salvation or the outworking of salvation. Of course, it is very related to the outworking of salvation. As I mentioned to the children, Halloween, Hallowed Eve, I'm not sure if you're aware, all these feast days have something that begins the night before, so if you want to be a real keener, and then you get the readings for the eve of the event, and that's what Halloween is. And then All Saints Day is a way to sort of catch all of the different saints that we have not commemorated individually. So if you go through the daily offices, if you follow the readings and the cycle of the church, you'll come upon saint days, a variety of saint days, some known and some more obscure. Here in the Anglican Church of Canada, we have some folks that we remember and commemorate that are specifically related to the Canadian context. And so that wouldn't be, you know, that wouldn't necessarily be commonplace for most of us, and for sure not elsewhere outside of the Anglican Church of Canada. But we can't pray for everybody, and so All Saints is sort of this time where we just say, we want to recognize the goodness of God and His faithfulness and how it has been demonstrated. It's a proof for us that what the Bible says is true, because we can show and demonstrate how other lives have been changed. Like James says when he talks about prayer, you know, he says Elijah was a man just like you and I, subject to the same limitations, human frailties. And that's what we can say about these people. There's been some pretty incredible things that people have chosen to do and disciplined, devoted their lives to. And sometimes there's these wild kind of contrasts between the previous, like the Amazing Grace guy, Newton. You know, like Newton was pretty much a wretch. Like when he says, I once was lost, but now I'm found, was blind, but now I see, or the saved a wretch like me. He's not using embellishment. He's not embellishing that part of his story. And so in All Saints Day, we just say, this is encouraging to us that God can and has in the past worked in the lives of people and that they've cooperated with the grace of God. And so we want to take encouragement and we want to be strengthened by rehearsing these acts of God's faithfulness in the lives of these His saints. So that's sort of the purpose. Then the church said, you know what, there's other people who've died, so we need an All Souls Day. So All Saints Day is November 1, All Souls Day is November 2. This year in the church, we're going to be celebrating next week our All Souls Day focus combined with our Remembrance Day, because it coincides with, you know, Remembrance Day on November 11th. So the death of all that we know, dear and near to us, and also the death of those who gave their lives in fighting for the country. So this is kind of this cluster of feast days that I think are little understood for us in the church. I mean, at least they are for me, and I've been doing this now as a priest for 12 years or so. And, you know, I'm still like, when All Saints rolls around, I'm like, what? Now, what's really the purpose of this thing again, and what are we supposed to be looking at? And the thing that stretches us outside of sort of our comfort zone, perhaps, and the Apostles' Creed says, I believe in the communion of saints. And the communion of saints, which is very clear in some of our prayers, in our collects, the church understands the communion of saints not to be just what's happening today around the world, people in the same time, but it extends beyond time to those who've lived even before Jesus. So Joseph, for instance, is part of the communion of saints, or Jacob, or Isaac, or Abraham. And potentially, I think it does, it extends into the future. So your your great-great-great-grandchildren, potentially, or whomever, generations to come, are part of this communion of saints. And that's where I think it gets a little weirder for us to think about. It's one thing to say, I'm one with everybody around the world who calls Christ Lord. I'm one with everybody in Medicine Hat who calls Christ Lord. There's no true division. There's no true difference. There's style differences, or, you know, there are some differences, but they're not a true difference. We are one. And I'm one with the folks in Tibet and Indonesia and Africa and, you know, the countries in Africa and Europe, and I'm one with all these people. But then to say I'm one with St. Augustine, and I'm one with Chrysostom, and I'm one with Elijah, and I'm one with John and James and Peter, that's probably a little harder for us. But that's what All Saints Day truly represents. And that does get us to this question of how is death related to this whole story? And All Saints Day, especially with our lectionary readings this year, death is clearly a theme, right? And not just death, but God's victory over death, God's removal. So Isaiah prophesying the good thing that God is going to do when he gathers all the nations to this holy mountain and he has this lavish feast, which is probably metaphorical at some level, just to say it's going to be a good thing and a great celebration. He removes the veil, the curse of death upon all peoples. And then John, at the tail end of the revelation, he sees that manifestation of God's final answer to human need and sin and decay in our created world by a new heaven and a new earth, the heavenly Jerusalem coming down. And God says, I'll wipe away every tear and I will destroy death. And then this lovely phrase, behold, I'm making all things new, which I just, I love. That's a great phrase, which again is a tie back to Isaiah. And then in the gospel, Jesus, and we jumped in midstream. You may be familiar with this story from John 11, but it's the whole chapter, or at least up to where we ended, beginning at verse 1, that the story unfolds. And just prior to Jesus, to Mary coming to see Jesus, Jesus had talked to Martha, Mary's sister, and he had said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me, though they die, will live. And those living and believing in me, though they die, they will not die finally or completely. And so there's this great claim that Jesus is making vis-a-vis death, in respect to death. So death is this important topic for us today on this celebration of All Saints. And as I said to the kids, and I owe this to C.S. Lewis, I'm not sure if he got it from somewhere else, this whole idea that you and I are, it's hard for us to think about being in communion with people dead, long dead, not just our own loved ones, but people gone centuries. How are we still in communion with them? And C.S. Lewis says, because we are inside time, we see things linearly, and all we can see is that to be in fellowship, I got to be next to you. But God's outside of time. All of time is present to God. My now is the same to God as Augustine's now, as Jesus' now, when he was on the planet, as Abraham's now, as Adam's now. All nows are one now to God. That's why I can be in fellowship with Abraham and God, because there's no before and after for God. Now, as I said, the early service, and I apologize for bringing Immanuel Kant in. It's never a good sign when a preacher brings Immanuel Kant into a sermon. And if you wonder what I mean, just go try and read the Critique of Pure Reason, and you'll get, you know, two pages in, you'll be like, yeah, I see. Anyhow, Kant says, Immanuel Kant, philosopher, late 1700s, early 1800s, he said that for humans to have intelligible thoughts, for you to have a thought that makes sense, it has to take place inside of these two concepts, time and space. The only human thinking that makes sense, that's possible, requires the constructs or the boundaries, the framework of time and space. So you and I really can't think intelligibly about God who's outside of time and outside of space. Just saying. I agree with Kant. I think he's right. I haven't had time to sort of really disagree with him. Kidding. But that's how this is all real. And Jesus himself, when he's talking to the Sadducees who denied that there was resurrection, came to him with a problem. They said, Jesus, we'll show you how ridiculous resurrection is. Moses said a man who dies not leaving children, his widow should marry his brother to raise up children for him. A woman married 7 men. They all died. She'd been married to them all. None had children. She didn't have children from any of them. In the resurrection, whose wife will she be? She can't be married to all 7. And Jesus says 2 things. He says, you're in error because you don't know the power of God and you don't understand Scripture. And then Jesus says, God, when he revealed himself to Moses, said, I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And says Jesus, God is not the God of dead people. So if God is the God of Abraham, who lived 400 plus years before Moses, then Abraham is alive. And in Luke's gospel, Jesus says, all are alive to him. All are alive to him. So that's kind of, that's the beginning of why the church does what they do. And Jesus, you know, anticipates C.S. Lewis and Immanuel Kant. Well, not Kant so much, but C.S. Lewis. He's, all are alive to God. That's how this communion of saints makes sense in context of our faith about who God is. But regarding death, and why this is an important construct, and why John basically crescendo. So if you read John's gospel, read it through, read the story the way it was relayed and told and written down by John, we get to a climax here with Lazarus and the raising of the dead, which makes sense, right? That's pretty exciting stuff. I mean, first of all, you can get pretty excited about people, blind people getting healed and this and that and the other thing, but dead people, 4 days dead? And I like the way, you know, John says, the dead man, he came out of the tomb. Jesus says, come forth, Lazarus. The dead man came out of the tomb, right? Just in case we missed that point, it's the dead guy. That's the one who's hearing the voice of Jesus. And Jesus is calling back out of the dead, out of the grave, and demonstrating so that you and I might believe his claim to be resurrection and life. And so that Mary and Martha and his disciples, Jesus said earlier in John 11, I'm glad I wasn't there, so that you might believe. How does that work? It works this way. Lazarus is dead. He's not just dead. He's dead. 4 days dead. In a hot Mediterranean climate with no refrigeration, nothing to halt decay. Well, you know what that would look like. And Martha knows what that would look like. And she says, Jesus, don't open the tomb. That's just nasty. And Jesus says, didn't I say you'd see the glory of God? What glory? That God is master in Jesus over death. Now, there's 2 other New Testament scriptures. This is where your brain's going to start to hurt. So Hebrews 2 says this. Talking about Jesus becoming the fitting high priest for us. Hebrews chapter 2, verse 14, since the children share in flesh and blood, he himself, Jesus, partook of the same. So Jesus too became human, shared in our flesh and blood, so that through death he might render powerless the one who had the power of death, that is the devil, and might deliver those who through fear of death were subject to slavery all their lives. So All Saints Day requires that we look squarely at this statement. The church, through Jesus, or in Jesus, has said that death has been destroyed When Jesus died, he destroyed death and he eliminated the power of Satan, who had the power of death. That's Satan's weapon. When humans die, they're Satan's. They leave fully and completely without any remainder of hope from this realm of life, where there's a possibility that one could experience God and life before God or with God, and they enter the realm of death, and that's the realm of Satan. Now, Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, towards the end, says, and the whole chapter 15, talks about death and resurrection, but Paul says that the power of death, or the sting of death, is sin. So that's why death does what it does, is because of sin. And why is sin powerful? Because the power of sin is the law. And now that's the picture before Christ or outside of Christ. When humans die, the lordship over their life, the authority, the claim over their life, their soul, is exercised by Satan, who holds the key to death. He holds the authority. He holds title. Jesus became human, suffered death so that he might plunder, as Jesus uses in another parable. You can't rob a strong man's house unless you're stronger than the strong man. And Jesus, in death, plunders Satan's kingdom and frees, through his death, those who their whole life were in slavery because of the fear of death. Now here's where we as 21st century Westerners have a hard time accessing this story. Virtually up until the last 80 years, all of humanity lived with a day-to-day knowledge about the potential of death. If you go back and read, like even in our Book of Common Prayer, the evening prayers, they're all about, you know, the little kid's prayer, if I die before I wake. You're like, well, what kind of thing is that for a kid to pray? But that's what we lived with up until the last 80 years or so. We lived with this. It was possible. You wake up in the morning, someone's dead. You know, there are practices in cultures where you don't actually name a child until they lived a certain time because they might die. That's just what we lived with. You could die in any number of ways or circumstances. And through that fear of death, because why is there fear of death? Because death is the final commentary on your life. Again, we don't live often in light of that. But death is the commentary on your life. It's not your bank account. It's not any number of other things. Your death proves the worth of your life. And so Jesus came to plunder the strong man and to free those who lived their life in slavery, a slavery through the fear of death. Again, we have a hard time, I think, accessing that today because most of us don't live in a conscious or daily or frequent understanding of our own mortality. So the claim of Jesus to be resurrection and life is this radical upsetting of the entire course of human existence and human experience. It's a revolutionary force. And I think it's important for us to reflect on this because this can become, week after week, kind of just, yeah, whatever. Yeah, Jesus died. Or whatever. Yeah, the blood, the body. But what's really going on here? You're proclaiming a radical freedom as a human now with the very life of God. A life that transcends death. And if it transcends death, it transcends every other limitation. Not, unfortunately, from our perspective, not so that we, you know, see a return to health necessarily, or a return to a financial flushness or whatever, but so that we don't live as slaves, even if we are ill, even if our finances tank, even if we don't live as slaves any longer. Now that's something. That's something you're not going to find anywhere else. And it's credible. That is, we can believe it. We can bank on it because of what God does in Jesus Christ. So Lazarus and the raising from the dead sets us up to hear the rest of the story when Jesus himself faces death. Right? I think like a good storyteller, John is saying, Jesus is going to death, we know that, but remember what happened to Lazarus. Remember what Jesus said about himself. This can't be the end of the story, right? I mean, unlike E.T., where you're like, what? He came back to life. No, that's not, you know. Sorry, scarred me for life. I just have to tell you, scarred me for life. One of the few movies I ever saw as a young man. And But John has prepared us for this. John has prepared us to know, no, this can't be the end of the story. The guy hanging on the cross is resurrection and life. How's that work? Well, it works this way. That Jesus plunders Satan and he leads captives captive. In his train, he liberates all those who under the fear of death lived their life in slavery, and upon death entered into the holdings of Satan. And Jesus has opened the gates of hell and freed the denizens of hell. And he leads us triumphant in a procession into the very throne room of God, into the Holy of Holies in heaven, where we join this throng. All the redeemed of ages gone and ages to come, and the angels, and all citizens of heaven, praising him, worshiping him. So how do we live our life today if that's true? Brothers and sisters, how do we live our lives today? If that's true, does the world say these Christians, they certainly are free? They certainly are free. So that's our challenge and our invitation today. The great heroes of faith, the saints who've gone before, show us what living truly free looks like. I don't think I need to help you find images of living in slavery. You know, we can find those fairly easy. What's your heart desire today? Will you follow him who calls from beyond the grave to us as dead persons? Come forth and walk in the light, in the life of the liberty of the children of God, bought with a price and with a purpose.